we're actually getting close to the point where Shane and your character showed up. We'll talk about that next episode.
Yeah.
Super excited.
I'm almost in the campaign.
Dun, dun, dun.
The campaign that I'm hosting a podcast about. Live from the Mundangerous Sweat Lodge in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 5 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
Today we're discussing alternative combat objectives. That is, how do you make combat more dramatic than simply, will the party survive, or will they kill everything?
And in the Character Creation Forge, we are going commando, or building commandos. Actually, I can only speak for myself, but both.
It's pretty appropriate to start with a dick joke.
Yeah, it's usually where we end up, so it seems like a natural place to start.
Just cut out the middleman.
Yeah, but before we do that, I want to talk about Akatacon 2015.
Please do.
So, Akatacon 2015 is being hosted by friends of the show, the RPG Academy podcast, in Cincinnati, Ohio, November 13th, 14th, and 15th. And it is live on Kickstarter, that's how they're funding it, which closes this Sunday, September 6th.
Shane, we should send someone.
I have already made arrangements. I'm going to fly out there.
Really?
Yeah. Well, we backed the Kickstarter and
we're
sponsors of the con, and it only seemed natural that I go out there.
You're like our con ambassador.
I am. That's because I like going to cons and meeting new people, and you're a misanthrope.
Yeah, that's true.
No, it's okay. It's okay. If you're a misanthrope like Ishan, or you just can't attend in person.
Or both.
They have set up a special backer level where they've arranged virtual games with some of the other podcasters in the RPG Academy network. Devin from Sharkbone or Christopher from the Sharkbone podcast. Each of them have one seat available, and I know the other three people in that game. They're a lot of fun. GM Jim McClure, who hosted the L5R game, The Legend of the Five Rings, on One Shot. He's already sold out one, but he has a second game that's up that has, I think, four seats available right now. And Darcy Ross, who runs a very good Cypher System Numenera Strange campaign, also has been on the One Shot podcast. She is running a virtual game as well.
So from the comfort of my tiny apartment in Brooklyn, I could be in a con game?
Mm-hmm, if you wanted to.
Do you want to name drop a little bit more?
You mean about the special guests?
Yes, that's exactly what I mean.
Well, I'm not responsible for any of this, but...
Yeah, we know. We know. It's been accomplished by people who are much better at this than you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So John Wick and Sean Carman, who both wrote Legends of the Five Ring, are going to be there. Robert Schwalm, who was a big writer on D&D 3rd edition.
Like everything.
Yeah, actually, yeah. He's written a ton of stuff. But he's also now doing Shadows of the Demon Lord, is his game that just closed on Kickstarter a couple months ago. Rich Baker, who...
Also everything.
He has a Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
He's like one of the old school TSR guys. Original D&D and Alternity and Gamma World... D&D 3E.
Wait, TSR is old?
I mean, not as old as you.
Oh, God. It's pretty old.
But you might be interested to know he wrote Dark Sun for 4th edition.
I did know that, and that is exciting.
Yeah. And then he's got his own campaign setting now called Primeval Thule, which is a pretty cool mashup of like Conan the Barbarian and Call of Cthulhu.
I just watched Conan last week.
Yeah.
For my birthday. It was awesome.
Getting ready for our feng shui game?
Yeah.
Okay. Also, A.P. Klosky, who wrote Cold Steel Wardens, will be there, as well as James D'Amato and Kat Murphy from the One Shot podcast, and DM Mitch and DM Chris from the DM's Block podcast. So a lot of people are going to be there, and the con isn't that big. There's only like 120 badges, so there's a good chance you're going to get to meet those people and actually spend some meaningful time with them instead of just shaking hands and getting a book signed.
Which is what you did at Gen Con.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's only like 30 badges remaining. So if you're interested, you should definitely act fast.
Aren't you running a couple games?
I am. If you would like to hang out with me at Akatacon 2015, you can sign up to play in my game of Dark Heresy.
Second edition.
Yeah. Where I hopefully will kill some players, but not too early.
You got to burn through those fate points, though.
I know. Yeah. But there's going to be some carnage. And then I'm also I'm not really running it, but I'm going to facilitate and participate in a game of Fiasco.
That's actually what we did a couple weeks ago because the GM for our Dark Heresy campaign was out. So it was my first time playing Fiasco.
Yeah, and it's not your typical game because it's very rules light and sort of improv comedy focused. So how did you like it?
You know, I feel like you don't know that much about me because I used to take a bunch of acting classes in improv. However, I enjoyed it. I did notice that you used, again, a Russian accent, which is the only thing you can do, I think.
Listen, when you have only two accents, you use both accents.
That's right. And I kept getting screwed up because I kept slipping into Russian when I was trying to maintain Cuban.
Okay? Yeah, yeah.
Yes, so yeah. It was 1953 Havana.
Right,
It was great.
It was, yeah. Only one death, though, which is a little bit low for a fiasco game. Usually there's like complete chaos at the end and multiple bodies, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's on the dice.
Yeah, that's true.
No, two deaths. The guy who needed all the drugs.
No, he lived. He lived.
Wait, what?
Yeah, he forgot.
Oh, he forgot.
he achieved his lifelong dream of finding enough drugs to forget.
Right. You almost got shot.
Yeah.
But it ended up with a party.
But yeah, so every time I've run Fiasco, it has been an absolute blast. So I'm looking forward to that. And then obviously Dark Heresy is more of a traditional RPG, and I think that's going to be a lot of fun as well.
All right, so let's get to the matter at hand.
Yes, alternative combat objectives.
How do you make combat more interesting? Because in a lot of systems, combat just drags, like hours for just a few rounds.
And I feel like one of the most common questions that you see from new DMs especially, or just people on the internet at large, how do I make my encounters more interesting? My combats aren't interesting.
Well,
maybe you just need to use different monsters or different terrain or make traps in combat.
Will those work, Shane?
They never work.
Why?
Because they're not actually interesting. Because what makes combat interesting is not what's in it. It's what does it matter to the story? So if you're always asking the dramatic question of will we survive or will we kill everything, that just gets tired. You need to make the dramatic question something else.
Right. It ends up being really binary. Once you hit that tipping point, oh, we're going to survive. Well, now we're going to kill everything.
Yeah, now we're just mopping up and trying to minimize the resources that we waste doing it.
Right, exactly. You may as well just hand wave the rest.
Exactly.
Which, honestly, some systems suggest, hey, you should just hand wave the rest. But I don't find that very clean, you know?
Yeah, and it's not very gratifying as a player that you spend time building your character and digging through your character sheet, and then as soon as you kind of hit your apex, it's like, we're done.
Yeah.
Moving on, mm-hmm. Right? So to me, the key behind our topic here, or sort of the point that we need to get to, is find something else in combat that makes combat an impediment. So it's not about killing everything in the room. It's about preventing a guard from triggering an alarm.
The goal is not combat, right? Except in those rare instances where, you know, it's you're in an arena or the point is to like assassinate someone. But even in an assassination, right? Like your point is to take out the target.
Yeah.
And then also not get caught.
Right.
You know? So yes, if the goal is something that combat just happens to sort of be there for, I find those far more interesting. And then of course, if a combat gets cut short, well, there's a reason that it's getting cut short, right? Our target is getting away, or, mm-hmm. you know, myriad reasons.
So let's talk about some examples of alternative combat objectives and maybe how we could use them in a campaign.
And I think that that's something that we'll sort of do throughout this episode, is sort of offer for GMs and then, of course, players to suggest as well, all different things and ideas that you can use in your own campaigns to spice combat up, or like we're saying, to not necessarily focus on combat, but to run alongside combat.
Right. And I think the goal for these, and the thing to keep in mind when you're making these decisions, what you want your players to do is to decide that there's something more important than hitting the guy in front of me.
What is that thing you always say about spicing combat up?
Oh, if you want to spice up combat, throw something off a cliff. Throw something really important, like a princess. See how fast the party will dive off a cliff to save her life.
Right, and stop like leafing through the sheets to see, I don't know, what's the best maneuver here?
Yeah, they're going to start leafing through their PHB to figure out how much falling damage can I survive?
Right, and they're still kind of asking, can I make climb checks because I want to make skill checks in combat. That's what I want to do right now.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what it takes, is something that just changes the dynamic where the players suddenly understand this isn't about fighting. This is about something more than fighting.
Loving.
Also saving the world. I don't know. Whatever. You do you.
Any of those. Yeah. Yeah. That sounds good.
So I like to kind of group some of these ideas in different categories, right? So the first one that I like to think of is the James Bond villain. where for some reason there's a timer ticking, and when that timer goes off, something bad is going to happen.
Of course, it doesn't need to be a literal timer, right? No,
it actually probably shouldn't be a literal timer. That would be a little too James Bond.
Well, and I will say it is sometimes nice to not necessarily see like a digital countdown, right? But for the players to know very specifically exactly how much time they have.
Yeah, yeah. Like, for example, in going back to our throwing a princess off a cliff example, if they can see the big bad climbing up the cliff, they can see roughly how long it's going to take before he gets to the top. Mm-hmm. That gives them sort of, not a physical timer, but back of their mind, how much time do we have left to screw around down here before we got to fix this?
And in general, it shouldn't be very much time at all.
No,
right?
No. It should be urgent.
Yeah.
So what are some examples in that category that DMs could use?
Well, my least favorite as a player is when I screw up my stealth roll and the guard sees me.
Yeah.
So that beanie is not working anymore and off he goes.
Yep.
And I think that this is sort of one of the common issues in the preview for 5e. The guard runs off and now suddenly you're fighting the entire complex, enter TPK.
You know, it could also be as straightforward as one of the important NPCs is in a cage that's slowly being lowered into a vat of acid.
It's
a little too Bond villain, isn't it?
I was actually thinking Enter the Dragon. Although, you know, the Joker fell into acid and then...
He turned out fine.
Yeah. You know, one of the best NPCs available. Although, actually, maybe the Joker's... But, oh, God, is the Joker a PC? He certainly has fate points.
Yeah.
The typical ritual where innocents are being sacrificed. I definitely use this in Morning Glory.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's probably one of the most common and honestly one of the most effective. It's not really cliched. It's just a classic useful trope.
Yeah. Spoiler alert. It's the confrontation Rise of Tiamat builds to. Oh. But you knew that was coming.
I didn't.
Well, now you do.
I mean, that makes sense. Yeah. Tiamat is a dragon god.
Yes. Of course. And you know, how do you... bring your horrible dark overlord into the world, you try to finish that ritual.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but lots of other things could happen with that ritual as well.
Mm-hmm. And you know, the party is definitely going to interrupt the ritual.
Although actually one of my favorites is when the party doesn't interrupt the ritual, and now the ritual is actually for the BBEG to power up.
Oh yeah.
Like I am completing my ascension, or I am, you know, attaching these robot parts or whatever. Oh, and we didn't stop him. Well, guess what? Now you have to fight him at full power. Congratulations.
Well, I actually like taking that a step further.
No. Oh.
Where the BBEG has now grown so powerful, he doesn't even care about the party anymore. He just leaves. Like, whatever's left behind is left behind, but he's got bigger things to worry about than the petty party, and now they've got to catch back up to him in order to stop him.
That's a nice sort of mid-level arc ending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it's definitely something, you know, level 10-ish, right? And it kind of sets you up for the remainder of your campaign.
Yeah, it really takes the party and sort of points them in a direction. I think that's something that you're looking for with these alternative objectives. You're trying to avoid in the first place, oh, let's make sure nothing's alive as the objective for combat. So in this instance, you're presenting the party with a new hook.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, a bomb can blow up. I played in a Planescape campaign where the first session was a bomb going off in a market. And that's how all of the PCs came together, is we were the ones who rushed toward the explosion while everyone else was rushing away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That one you might want a literal timer. I'm just thinking. That one...
It can be fun. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
We'll talk about it in a later episode, but you kind of did do that to us.
Yes. Yes.
In Morning Glory. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I guess there was actually like a definite, very distinct
definitely
timer.
Definitely a timer, yeah, on a bomb.
Yeah,
that was very, very scary.
The timer was a little random, which actually I think made it nice as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another group of scenarios is what we might call the Indiana Jones, where combat is sort of in the way of you getting to the physical location that you're trying to get to, or an object or something. So, you know, you're inside a temple and the big stone door is sort of coming down, but that's not combat at all.
No, it's fine, because that's an easy one to kind of combine to one of the others. So when the ritual is completed, it threatens the structure of the temple that it was performed in, or when the bomb goes off, the party has failed. They've survived. Now they have to see if they can even get out.
Failing forward.
Right.
One of my favorite scenes, I guess, combat / skill check / scene setting is the opening scene to Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Right, so it's not the best movie, but you've got Indy, who's just been poisoned, right? the poison, Dr. Jones. Mm-hmm. You just drank it, right? And then his friend gets shot, right? There's a guy with a machine gun, so there's obviously combat. People are getting punched. There's people dancing on the floor. You're looking for a diamond. It's scooting all around on the ground. You run behind the giant gong, and then it falls. There's traps all over the place. There's gangsters. He doesn't want to fight, but that's certainly an option. He needs to get that antidote and that diamond.
That's what I like to call total chaos.
Yeah.
But yes, that is a culmination of throwing everything in at once and seeing what sticks.
Works really well also when there's a thing that nobody wants rather than everyone wants.
Right. Yeah. If you're trying to avoid something, sort of playing hot potato.
Here, you hold this bomb.
Yeah. Yeah. But going back, drawing again from the Indiana Jones sort of plot, you've also got fighting your way to a plane or a boat that's taking off with or without you, and you're trying to make sure that you get on board.
And of course, once you've thrown the bomb at someone else, maybe it backfires on the players. I really enjoy throwing that one at you guys. It's the dead man switch. It is an alternative to combat because combat results in all of you dying, because as soon as the bad guy dies, well, his suicide vest goes off.
Yep.
Or, you know, the magic ritual that he casts is no longer sustained by his life force, so it crumbles, and now literally hell breaks loose.
Like we said with the total chaos, when you daisy chain these together to where one set of events, if they succeed in this, something happens, and if they fail in this, something else happens. Mm-hmm. You can keep chaining these together, and they feel new and exciting every time, even though they're kind of pulling from the same sort of tropes.
I think we'll talk about this in a later episode with dealing with boss encounters, right? Stages are always certainly more interesting than static encounters.
Yeah, absolutely. So another one of the tricky DM moves, if you have dying minions powering up their boss. Mm-hmm. So as you want to fight all the mooks around you, you're actually just making the boss stronger.
And of course, it's not going to be obvious until you've already killed a few mooks.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Although, I say maybe early on, you've faced these kind of things and you realize, oh, this is the mechanism. And then later on, it's sort of nice for players to be rewarded for remembering that bit of trivia is, oh, if you kill these skeletons, like the golem gets stronger.
And the alternative to simply having minions that have to die, you can also have different props that are powering up that boss, right? So as you destroy the focus crystals spread around the chamber, it weakens the boss's ability to use his spells.
I think that can sometimes feel a little video gamey, but as a mechanism within the game, it works really well, because then you have parties sort of divvying up tasks. You know, you go like smash that crystal, I'll go get this one over here, you grab the lever. And it makes players, it shakes up their typical tactics.
Yep.
You know, so I think early on it's nice when they develop tactics to use in combat. Everyone sort of knows their role, but then from then on, it's nice to make them come up with new scenarios.
Yeah, and you said video gamey, but don't take that as a negative, because there's a reason it works well in video games, right? It gives you an opportunity to choose a different approach than what you've done up to that point.
And then after a while, it sort of becomes obvious that that is the goal for the party, and you don't need to explicate it for them.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there's sort of another classic trope, the hold the line. Maybe when you need an elaborate distraction to cover for somebody else in the party, maybe they're breaking in or hacking, or there's a prison break, or you're trying to defuse that bomb. You've got to keep the enemies off of him while they try to slow him down.
I feel like this is almost sort of the inverse of the countdown. You're trying to last till morning.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yep.
Obviously, you know, hold the line 300, right? There's maybe an infinite number of versions coming, or even Helm's Deep, I suppose, right? The Ride of the Rohirrim is, or at least the traveling to Helm's Deep is really just a ploy to evacuate all the women and children and the non-combatants.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a nice way, I think, for combat-focused characters to feel effective, you know, because they're supposed to be slaughtering as much as possible and surviving, you know, and still moving plot forward and having them do something that is useful, not just for themselves.
And it's also, they're using their abilities in a slightly different way than they normally are. Because normally you target the biggest, baddest thing in the room and you focus fire. But when you do sort of a hold the line scenario, it's really about distributing your damage as far across the group as you can, because they're generally going to be very weak enemies coming at you.
Right.
And you pair that with waiting for reinforcements, or my personal favorite is just kind of lampshade the trope and actually make it a physical threshold that you're defending. So maybe a breached castle wall or hallowed ground that the undead will desecrate, or preventing them from entering a magic portal.
So once you've decided on some alternative combat objectives, how do you present them or introduce them into the encounter without making it seem so obvious?
Well, you hinted on it a little bit before, but I think the key to everything is building the context into the story and making sure that the objective that you're choosing for that particular combat fits within that story. If you tell the party what the MacGuffin will be used for, that kind of puts a lot of context around it. For example, if they're looking for an antidote, let them know we've been poisoned. We have an hour before the poison takes its effect. We got to find the antidote in an hour. And naturally, they should get their eyes on the antidote in the last minute or so.
Right, especially when you're dealing with, for most games, combat rounds.
Yeah, which, yeah, absolutely.
You know, a few seconds.
Right.
Yeah, when I say, you know, introduce it in a way that isn't too obvious, sometimes the obvious way is the one that makes the most sense, you know? I just jabbed you with a needle. You're going to die in an hour. Congratulations.
Right.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if there's a ritual going on, when you stumble in and interrupt it, I mean, it's pretty obvious. This is probably bad. You didn't need to know why the children from the town went missing. All you need to know when you walk in is that the children are being used for something bad. You're going to figure out that you need to save the kids, right?
Although, I do love to invert it, because the party stumbled in. They don't have perfect information. Do you remember what happened when you guys stumbled in on a mutated Tyrannosaurus Rex and a bunch of drow?
That was both my most proud moment as a gamer who enjoys the kill count aspect of a session. I used a single cantrip, and I think it netted me like 15 or 16 deaths.
Yep.
Unfortunately, the scenario that we stumbled in upon was a mutated, aberrant Tyrannosaurus Rex who had lots of tentacles growing out of his back, who was sort of at a standoff with a couple groups of drow, and they were in this clearing in the middle of Zendrick, in the middle of the jungle, magical jungle. And we saw them sort of spread out around the clearing, plan our point of attack, and then I kicked it off by throwing my voice in order to convince the drow that it was time to attack the T-Rex all in mass. And the T-Rex destroyed them.
Horribly. It was tragic.
But why was that a bad idea?
Because they weren't bad people.
Okay, they were bad people. But the point was, they weren't actually going to attack each other until I intervened.
Yes.
They were taking shelter, I think, from sort of a magical storm that was going on within the jungle that wasn't affecting the clearing.
And they were potential allies. It was actually why I put them there, which is interesting that you sort of became this catalyst between the two separate groups. Because another option that I think a lot of people do is to have the party stumble in the middle of a more obvious ritual, i.e. like in the middle of combat. There's already a battle going on. Mm-hmm. And then the party is just sort of deciding in the moment, right? Within one or two rounds, are we going to intervene? And if we are, which side?
Or maybe say there are two rival adventuring parties after the same artifact. Can we maybe just sneak around them? Can we maybe steal the MacGuffin, steal the artifact before they even realize that we've done it? Spoiler, no, they cannot.
Or they can, but something else bad happens.
Fair enough.
Right, like failure is interesting, you know. I think that's one of the things about alternative combat objectives is failure in combat means the story's over.
Right.
Right. TPK, everyone go home, or like roll up some new characters. Yep. But failure with one of these objectives actually can push the story forward.
So, on that note, one of my favorite DM tricks, and actually to experience as a player, is the Sophie's Choice.
Where, it's a super depressing name for this.
Okay, but it's what it is. It's where the party can't achieve both objectives. They have to fail at something and they have to decide, right? So they can save the princess, but then the big bad escapes. Or they can kill the big bad, but that will doom a whole city. For me as a player, I like when the storyline takes a turn directly because of our actions, right? We know that when we made that choice, something else closed off. And it gives you that feeling of, I influenced the direction of this campaign. It could have gone left or right, and we went right. We chose right.
As a GM, I really like those moments, the sort of crucible moments where a character finds out something about themselves, right? So yeah. Maybe the player, when they create the character at first level, doesn't necessarily know what that character would have chosen, right, in that moment. But, you know, now you spend all this time with them, you develop these idiosyncrasies, these other goals, and then they make a decision. And that colors the direction of that character's arc for the rest of the story.
Yeah.
Those are great.
But as a DM, you have to be prepared for either outcome.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because you can't, if you try and guess their reaction, I think you just end up second guessing their decision and trying to shade them towards what you picked instead of really having a true choice.
Yeah. None of this, are you sure?
Right.
Right. Oh, you did it. This is happening. Enjoy some consequences.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No. And also keep in mind, when you do that, and when you draw that line and you go forward with one to the detriment of the other, the party will fight back. Like, the players will not be thrilled. Like, they'll try and undo things or figure out something else they could have done. But don't let them.
They want to win everything. Yeah, of course. Yeah,
just stick with it. Nope. You made that choice. We're moving forward. It's okay. You made the right choice. You made the wrong choice, but you also made the right choice. So I think in Morning Glory, you used this a number of times, and that's one of the things that made it such a fun campaign, was that our combats were always so varied. But as far as where we are, how we've advanced the story thus far in the podcast, we are in Sharn, and there was a pretty good example there as well, right?
Yeah, I think as a GM, you guys were so good in combat for the most part that I had to come up with other things that you can do. After a while, it was either, okay, this is going to be a ridiculously difficult combat, but your main objective is something different, or, okay, you'll probably steamroll these guys, but your main objective is something different.
There were a couple fights, I think, that we had where we could just tell it was a bag of hit points. And taking down a 50% larger bag of hit points isn't substantially more fun for a player.
I mean, it's certainly not fun for GM either, right?
Right.
Like, oh, more subtraction. Awesome. So, in the Morning Glory campaign, you guys were in Sharn. So the party had discovered that there are demons bound in objects, in much in the same way that elementals are bound in certain objects. That's super weird. But they also have a sentient artifact that they think might be tied to House Caneth, and they're trying to discover more about it. So,
my boy Cube.
Oh, yeah. You guys got along really well.
I like Cube a lot. He got me.
See, that makes me happy because, you know, it was an NPC that I developed that you guys carried around literally, like, on your waist or your head.
No, I literally wore him as a belt.
Yeah.
He was my championship belt.
Even though you weren't a grappler.
No, true. But I could have been a contender.
So the Sphinx tips them off, as she already has before, tips them off to an abandoned Caneth facility deep in the cogs. And so in order to get there, it's swarming with fire elementals because it's a manifest zone to Fernia. And basically, it's a mad dash across an open field of rubble, avoiding the fire elementals and occasionally killing the fire elementals. But the whole point is, of course, to get to a door far, far away. And then once inside, it is an abandoned facility that was destroyed on the Day of Mourning. And now it becomes more an intrigue-based encounter. So there's multiple levels of this Caneth facility. Last episode, we talked about magic items. So one of the things that I did was present some artificer items. House Caneth is made up of mostly artificers. Items that could upgrade regular items into magic items. And I sort of developed a template where if it was applied to a weapon, it would do this. If it was applied to armor, it would do this. And I just sort of left it there and then had them decide if they wanted to apply it and what they wanted to apply it to. So that was certainly that was an interesting alternative reward. So a few horrible things they discovered afterward. One, they found data from the Day of Mourning implicating House Caneth in Seer, which was sort of a bit devastating for the paladin survivor of Seer. They also discovered a torture chamber full of warforged body parts. And this was a way for me to sort of gauge what direction they wanted to take their characters in, right? Because they found a torture chamber. How do they react to these sort of Mengele-type experiments performed on warforged by House Caneth? And they also discovered a survivor 4 years later, a warforged who had been kept in total sensory deprivation for 4 years and was completely insane and tried to kill them. And much to my surprise, they did not kill her. They knocked her out and took her with them as they tried to escape, which, of course, was difficult to do because there was a dead man switch on the data, which released a ton of elementals, which there was absolutely no way that they could fight all at once. I suppose they could have kited them, and I thought they might do that, but they didn't. The cleric cast Sanctuary on everybody, and then they ran really, really quickly. Yeah. I was really surprised that it worked, but yeah, it totally worked. It was
nice.
Great.
Nice. So let's talk about how to pace those sessions then, where you've got combats that are just straight up fights and where you've got these sort of alternate combats. How do you pick the right pace so where it doesn't just become very contrived every time? You know, every time you walk into a fight, there's some twist on it. It just stops being a twist, right?
Yeah. So I think contrary to the impression that I sort of try to give off, I do a lot of last minute planning when it comes to campaigns.
No joke.
Yeah. But part of that is because our group has multiple players who just have very busy lives. I mean, all of us do, but some people have jobs that are just really unpredictable. So you can never count on a particular player being at a particular session, which is, it's difficult to plan plot rewards when you don't necessarily know if the person that you put it in there for is going to be there. So, you know, usually we'll know a few days ahead of time, and I'll know, you know, if there is a potential combat coming up. So then I begin to think about, okay, what is the goal of this, and how is this particular combat or this particular encounter objective structured? And I usually sort of try to play to both the strengths and the weaknesses of whatever party I expect that I'm going to have in play. What about you?
Well, in a little more concrete terms, I think it's a good starting point to maybe every third session to introduce sort of an alternative based on, you know, one combat per session, you know, maybe the occasional second combat per session if they're a little light, but, you know, just so it gives it a twist, but it keeps combat familiar for the most part.
Yeah, you don't have to relearn the rules every single time. I think if most groups are meeting once a week, then, you know, it's about every 3 weeks,
right?
Which is, yeah, it's good for you remember the last time it happened.
Right. But as with all of our advice, you have to tailor this to your particular play group. And I think in this case in particular, because combat is such a central part to how role-playing games are played and people react to it differently, I think you really need to look at Robin's Laws of Game Mastering, where he identified the 7 types of players, and take a look at your group and figure out what kind of players do I have and then adjust accordingly. So for example, power gamers, they might not play along very nicely with this. They might try to game the parameters that you set out for an encounter and try and break it before you really have a chance to develop.
And of course, we've talked about before, you and I certainly have a definite power gaming streak in us, but no person is all one archetype.
Right.
Yeah. A power gamer, I think, again, this is a table issue, you know. When I presented an odd combat to you guys, I fully expected that you, specifically, like Shane, would say, so, okay, wait, I have an idea. Can I get away with this? You know, and, you know, 50% of the time, I would have to be like, no, obviously you can't. No, maybe that works raw, but obviously this is not working here.
Yeah, but that's, I'm a polite power gamer.
Sure, exactly.
Not everyone is going to get that, right?
And that's what I mean, yeah. Right? Like, if you don't have a polite power gamer, well, I'm sorry, GM. You're just going to need to probably smack him down and put him in line.
Right.
You know?
What about butt kickers?
These are people who are almost solely focused on combat. They like the minutiae. They like feeling, you know, powerful. And you just need to make sure that you're presenting something for them to do while the rest of the party is completing all those alternate objectives.
Yeah, I think they're going to like it just fine. You know, maybe they're fighting slightly different people in the group than they would be otherwise, but I mean, they're still rolling their dice and swinging their axes, so I think they're going to be fine.
Yeah. And tacticians love strange encounters.
Oh, yeah. The tacticians can't get enough of these things. And the more information they can gain over the course of it and sort of course correct as the combat goes on, the more they're going to love it.
In the same vein, specialists are sort of tacticians within their own particular sphere. Right. So this is a little more difficult because you have to make sure that they're sort of like, along with the butt kickers, you need to make sure that there is something for them. Of course, because this is an encounter not solely geared around slogging through a combat, this is an ideal opportunity to present things that'll help them shine.
Yeah, this is actually one of the reasons you might be looking for alternative combat objectives in the first place, is that your specialists aren't enjoying your combats because they're very straightforward and not giving them a chance to do what they came to do.
Yeah, 5e specifically has this three-pillar structure. And
yeah, so the three pillars are exploration, skill, and combat.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I love it. You know, I don't like just being okay with shoehorning the character into a particular zone of expertise.
Yeah.
And obviously they use the pillar structure because you're supposed to support your campaign with all of them.
Right.
But I don't like being like, okay, well, we're going to trade off. Like, first we're going to do some skill stuff and then we're going to do some combat. Like, the point of this we're talking about is combine it all together all the time. There should always be the possibility of combat.
And the exploration pillar is the least specialized of the three, so it's unlikely that you're going to have anybody built for that. And across the skill versus combat spectrum, this is an opportunity to bring skills and make them more useful in combat scenarios, because unfortunately, regardless of how you structure your campaign, it's likely that combat will take the most time, like actual game time. Even though it's only 30 seconds of your story, it's going to take an hour or two of your session.
So what about story-focused players?
You mean the method actor and the storyteller?
Yes.
So I think as long as you tie these combat objectives into your story and you've given them enough story context, I think they're going to love it. I think it's going to draw them more into the combat that they otherwise might not enjoy.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's one of the best ways to get them involved. And also a great way to get the casual gamers involved. And we talked about this a little bit before, but you're trying to break this person sort of out of their mold of not particularly caring all that much or not being particularly invested in the actions of their player. So, you know, giving them more interesting options is certainly going to help pull them in.
Yeah, and at the very least, it won't hurt them. You know, they won't mind that combat is a little different this time if they're not looking to get out of their shell.
Right. So there's a low bar.
That's the nice thing about casuals. So do you hear that, Ishan?
Oh, God. It's my tinnitus, but you can hear it. Oh, it's spreading.
Wrong, my friend. That sound can mean only one thing. It's time to move on to the Character Creation Forge.
Whew.
But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from our dozen listeners.
Dozens.
Ooh.
Our dozens of listeners can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, M-U-N, dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show, at TPTcast.
So, what did we build this week?
We built a commando.
And what does a commando do?
The commando is kind of a modern archetype. It's your special forces guy, right? But we've tried to adapt it for fantasy, and there's not really a historical analog for that.
Right. One-man army is a relatively recent development.
Right.
Because, you know, you're in plate armor. You can't even get off your horse.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But when you think of the commando, you think of someone who's highly skilled in survival, stealth, tactics, and he's perfectly fine on his own.
Yeah, although they should be able to operate as part of a team.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, you should love having a team of commandos. If they're all capable individually, you don't want abilities that step on each other's toes.
But keep in mind, that's kind of what an adventuring party is. It's a team of commandos, right?
Something to think about.
Once you hit a high enough level. But so what are the sort of mission profiles that we're thinking of when we build our commando characters?
So I think you and I were thinking we're essentially placing this character behind enemy lines. They should be able to take out the enemy, right? So capable of assassination.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be able to sneak around without getting caught. Ideally, while they're sneaking around, they're making things difficult for the enemy. So sabotage.
Yep.
They should be able to gather information and bring that information back to the party. So reconnaissance.
Yep.
And if necessary, and they're stuck out behind enemy lines for a long time, they should be able to mount a pretty decent guerrilla warfare campaign.
Right, because they should be resourceful.
Absolutely. So the way you took this was basically to build a Navy SEAL.
Yep, that was my approach.
All right, let's talk about it.
That was the most commando-ish commando I could think of at the time. So the Navy SEAL, I would build with start with a Rogue One.
Yes, of course.
Because I love Rogue One.
I also start with Rogue One. Why wouldn't you do that?
Right.
Yeah.
So for all the usual reasons, most notably expertise, though sneak attack will also be handy for this character. Then I went for 5 levels of Ranger.
We don't usually see a lot of Ranger here in the Forge. I think this is the first time it's come up.
Yeah, Ranger is not the most powerful of the classes, and it also doesn't have a lot to offer as a splash. So you see us pick Cleric, or we pick a couple levels of Fighter, or a couple levels of Bard, or a level of Rogue, because they give you good abilities up front. The Ranger really doesn't have anything that makes a splash early.
I think, yeah, the Ranger doesn't really have its own niche anymore. I think a lot of it's sort of covered by Fighter, which has more options now, and Druid, which has tons of spells.
Yeah, and now that two-weapon fighting just isn't that hard to get, it's really diminished the Ranger's role, I feel like.
Right, which is a shame, because Ranger's always been my favorite flavor-wise class. But
yeah, I always like the Ranger Archer, and it's, you know,
may as well just build a Fighter.
Fighter just does it better.
Yep.
So, you know, I mean, like, Legolas was always the Ranger in my mind, but now I think Legolas is a Fighter.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And Aragorn, too, who's literally the Ranger.
Literally named the Ranger. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm glad to see that you have it in the build.
Okay, so 5 levels of Ranger will get you to your second attack, and the Colossus Slayer is the archetype you want to go for. That gives you extra damage when you attack an enemy who's already been damaged. Then I went for 4 levels of Druid. Not a typical choice, because Druid is pretty strong on its own, but I like that will give you the ability to beast shape into swimming animals, which, you know, if you're a Navy SEAL, you need to be ready to be aquatic, right? From there, I went back to Ranger for another 5 levels. So that will give you Hide in Plain Sight as well as Land Stride. One, Hide in Plain Sight is a fantastic way to enable your own sneak attacks.
Super flavorful.
Yeah, and I mean, that is the move in Predator where Arnold is hiding from the Predator covered in mud. Under the tree, in the rain, like that's his move. And then Land Stride makes it easy for you to move across the terrain. I then went back to Druid for the final 5 levels. And at this point, I should note, you want to be a Druid Circle of the Moon for the coast, because that gives you Mirror Image, Misty Step, Water Breathing and Water Walk, Control Water, and Freedom of Movement.
That's an excellent list of spells.
I mean, pretty much the most flavorful list you can get for a Navy SEAL, I feel like.
Right.
And then the other bonus, that will take you to 9 total levels of Druid. That will get you Flying Beast Shapes. So now, if you run into problems, you can just turn into an owl and fly away without provoking attacks of opportunity.
Or turn into a raptor in the first place and do some reconnaissance.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the way this is kind of going to feel, the Ranger's going to be able to move around behind enemy lines without much issue. He's going to have survival as a skill because he's a Ranger. And he gets a bunch of bonuses to favored terrain and those sorts of things, which are very thematic.
And tracking.
Yeah, and tracking, yeah. And not being able to be tracked, those sorts of things. But the key here is going to be that assassinate move, which really comes into its own once you hit Ranger 5 and you get your second attack.
Right. So we should clarify, not literally the assassinate class feature from Rogue 3, but an actual like in-game assassination.
Yeah, your attempt to, you have one target and you are going to kill that target as quickly as possible.
Right.
So for me, that move is to use Hunter's Mark, which is a Ranger spell, and sneak attack. So you're going to sneak up on him, get advantage on your attack as well. On your first attack, that'll give you a bonus 2d6 damage. And then on your second attack, you'll trigger your Colossus Slayer because that enemy will already be weakened or already be wounded. So right there, you're adding 2d6 and a d8 on top of your regular weapon damage, which is great. And that's just the first round of combat. So in the second round, he might hit you once, but you're probably going to kill him. And that's at 6th level.
Did you mention you're making those attacks with advantage, most likely, because they're not going to see you coming?
Right.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, I mean, that's key.
I can definitely picture this guy with camouflage like on his face and slowly rising up out of the water with a knife in his teeth.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the thing. But he also might be a crocodile.
Right. Right. And that's the best thing, right? Maybe he... Because I think you're going to do most of your killing in humanoid form, right?
Yeah, probably.
So he pops up, kills, and then, disappears. Either flies away, slithers away, swims away.
Right.
Yeah.
But you could also use your beast mode or beast form to infiltrate and then switch into humanoid, say, behind the guard and just kill him.
Right, who's going to pay attention to a rat or a sparrow?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're all over the place.
I dig it.
So your approach used the Shadow Monk, which I have never seen used before. either in play or even in like a theory craft build. So I'm excited for this.
It's actually not true. Bahar was a shadow monk. Remember, he kept teleporting in shadows.
Oh. Hey. Well, I've never seen a Shadow Monk 9.
That's a fair point. Okay. So I go monk, rogue, and if you want, you can throw in some warlock. Maybe that works for you. Maybe it doesn't. We'll see. I'll throw it in as an option. So for race, I really like Wood Elf. You get faster movement, you get +2 to dex, and +1 to wisdom, which is also key. Dex and wisdom are your two main stats, and you're going to want to max them both as much as you can. Let me say, in general, when we're talking about the order of levels for these builds, we want to make them playable from 1 to 20. So, you know, you can start at 1 and you enjoy playing it for as long as you do play it. So when we sort of suggest the order in which you should take levels, we're basically making that decision based on what is the best option at that particular level. So there's definitely often a lot of sort of bouncing back and forth.
Yeah, and generally where that comes into play on martial characters is getting extra attack. You don't want to delay getting your extra attack too long. Otherwise, you start to feel very ineffective in combat, and you're only rolling half as many dice as the rest of the table, which is a kind of crappy feeling.
Right, and sort of the same thing we do with spellcasters is you want to get to those sort of magical levels, right? Third level spells, fifth level spells.
Right.
So you can take these in almost any order that you want, but obviously let's start with Rogue One, you know, again, all the usual reasons. Then I like 9 levels of Shadow Monk. Shadow Monk gets you so much. It gets you on armor defense, wisdom to defense. Obviously, you can wear light armor because you started off as a rogue, but if you're in the wilderness and you're stuck without any, you're perfectly fine. And I think eventually, once your wisdom's high enough, you're not going to want any. You get fast movement. Shadow Monk at level 3 gets you pass without trace, silence, and darkness. You almost get these at will. You have to spend key points to use them, but you're getting your key points back on a short rest. And how often for every short rest are you going to have to cast Paths Without Trace, Silence, or Darkness? Now, Paths Without Trace is probably one of the best stealth spells out there. Shane's Druid Ranger gets it as well, just because both of those classes get Paths Without Trace. But it's +10 to stealth. +10. Like that's crazy, right? Especially stacking with Rogue Expertise.
Yeah. Once you've got Expertise and Stealth, I mean, it's over.
No one is going to see you. Silence, I love that you can get silence on something other than a cleric. And of course, you know, they probably won't hear you, but if you want to be absolutely sure that no one hears you, silence. It doesn't matter if they scream. Or darkness. Darkness is great too, especially at night, it gets even darker, but, you know, completely blind people. And then you also get Stunning Strike at Monk 5. So that almost sort of creates the package, right? You're stealthing. They can't see you or hear you. You drop either a silence or a darkness. You pop up and hit them with Stunning Strike, and then it's all over because you're just flurrying and they can't do anything. Even if you don't kill them right away, you've basically got as long as you want because they're stuck in silence or darkness. Monk also gets you evasion. At Monk 6, you can teleport in shadows, which is really great for your mobility. And at 9, you can run up walls. And then I like to hop back into Rogue. And you can do this a lot earlier. I think maybe as soon as you have Stunning Strike, you can, if you want, hop back into Rogue. And that gives you Cunning Action, which if you think about a non-combat situation, if you want to cover as much terrain as possible, you're using your Monk fast movement, your Wood Elf higher base speed, and you're just running and Cunning Action. There's no one who can keep up with you except maybe a flying druid.
Hey, I know one of those.
You also build up your sneak attack dice. You grab Uncanny Dodge, which is amazing for your tanking capabilities. And I take Arcane Trickster. I pretty much don't recommend anyone take Arcane Trickster. But in this instance, it gets you Mage Hand Ledger Domain, which lets you use your Mage Hand from a distance to either pickpocket or put things in someone's bag. So I'm thinking tying shoelaces, if you can get some sort of magical grenade or alchemist fire, you can pick locks from a distance, all those sorts of things. And then if you can get all the way to 11, you can get reliable talent, which of course means you're never rolling less than a 10 on any of these. That might be overkill though. Now, I present this as an option because if you notice, Monk 9 and Arcane Trickster 11, you're already at your 20 levels. So you're going to need to drop 2 levels of something if you want to do Warlock 2. That means you do need to invest a little bit in Charisma, Charisma 13, but I still think you should go with Wood Elf because your main stats are still going to be Dex and Wisdom. If you want, you could go Lightfoot Halfling, but you've got a slower movement speed. And Warlock is mainly for two invocations, and you can choose different ones, but the best ones are Fiendish Vigor, which is False Life at will, 1d4 plus 4 temporary hit points. You cast it at will, so you just keep casting it until you get 8 temporary hit points. This is really great for self-sufficiency, particularly at low levels. As soon as you're not in combat, get yourself more temp HP. But I think I would probably take Disguise Self at will. That's amazing for infiltration, right?
Yeah.
Sure, the Spare can get inside, but I can walk right in.
You
right
can just be the guard.
That's right. And then probably my favorite one is Devil Sight, which lets you see in normal and magical darkness, which means you can drop your darkness and you can still see them. So they can't see, they can't hear, you're just fine. There's really no way that they're getting out of this. And then the rest you get from Warlock is just basically just gravy. I think any good commando would probably take Eldritch Blast just to have it when necessary.
Yeah, you need a big gun once in a while.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes you're like, what? Yep, let's shoot everyone.
I mean, that is literally walk softly and carry a big gun.
And then for first level spells, Hex. Hex is fine.
So would you drop 2 levels of Monk or 2 levels of Arcane Trickster?
I mean, this is like assuming you're getting to level 20, right? I would probably drop Monk because you only really lose being able to run up walls, which at that point, you have Arcane Trickster. You have a bunch of other wizard spells. So you could get Levitate. You can, if you want, take Athletics as one of your rogue skills and pop your expertise onto it because you get 4 expertises from more than 6 levels of rogue. So you're never going to have a problem climbing. And then, of course, once you get Reliable Talent, you'll never fall.
Right.
So, yeah, I would probably do that. And I would probably go for Warlock
pretty early, right?
Yeah, I think once I had Stunning Strike and Cunning Action, so that's 5 Monk, 2 Rogue, maybe 3 Rogue just to get Mage Hand, Ledger, Domain, then I'd go Warlock.
So you would hit level 10 of Warlock. You'd up your Eldritch Blast at that point as well.
Right.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. And then at that point, I mean, you can continue with the rest of this build, but you can do anything that you want.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you've already got a great base.
So, the seminal question.
Ooh.
Which one would you rather play?
I think your Navy SEAL is very good and very useful. But I think in building these characters, I've been becoming more partial to all of the goodies that the Monk package brings. So I think I would like to play my build. What about you?
See, I think your build is a little bit better at the... It's like a ninja.
Mm.
More than really a commando. Because he uses kind of tricks to get by.
Turning into a sparrow isn't a trick.
Okay, it's a party favorite. But more practically speaking, I think your monk is going to be much better in a solo campaign where he's not hampered by the rest of the party. Whereas I think my ranger will fit into a party pretty well and still have those tricks up his sleeve to kind of go do his own thing out in the vanguard if he needs to.
Yeah, I think certainly darkness and devil sight is not going to be very party friendly.
Right. Yeah. And so for that reason, I think I would rather play my Navy SEAL ranger just because he's going to play better in a group and I'm unlikely to ever play a solo campaign.
What if I change the race to drow? And then they can basically darkness at will but can still see in it. Then how would you feel? Because drow doesn't play well with party anyway.
I mean, I wouldn't play
drow. You don't
drow.
Want to play drow. That's why I didn't pick drow.
Because it doesn't play well with parties. And I tend to like my role-playing games with groups.
All right. We will agree to disagree.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to.
So you go.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode, Ishan?
Oh, we'll be talking about travel. Are we there yet?
We will be soon, but first we'll stop by the Character Creation Forge, where we'll discuss the bodyguard.
Oh, Whitney. Tragic.
And on that macabre note, that's it for episode 5 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.